Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special podcasts. This one is dedicated to Patty Jenkins' Superman, the first Avenger, Wonder Woman. And it is a first, relatively speaking, for the Empire podcast because we do not have an interview with the director, Patty Jenkins, but you guys wanted us to talk about the movie. We wanted to talk about the movie because we love the movie. And so here we are. So joining me over the next hour or so to talk about Wonder Woman are two of my very own...
Do it.
Wonder Women.
Hey.
Oh.
Fresh from Themis itself. Please welcome Themyscira. Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And Empire's Editor-in-Chief, Terry White.
Hello.
And then, last but not least, the himbo of the podcast, the eye candy, if you will, it is James Dyer.
Thanks, Chris.
You all right?
Yeah.
Good. Glad to hear it. Our very own Steve Trevor, or Trevor Steve.
James is very excited about this one, aren't you, James?
I like this, I'm going to own this.
Now, unlike the last spoiler special podcasts dedicated to the movies from the DC Extended Universe, we like this film, don't we? Unlike Suicide Squad and, to a lesser extent, Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice.
A similar extent, if I'm honest.
Yeah, I like that film. The three-hour version is better.
I mean, I've seen it and I disagree, but sure.
Yeah. And there's Man of Steel. There's good things that happen in Man of Steel. Anyway, we like this film, don't we?
Yay!
Everyone's happy about this. Yes.
And in fact, I've liked it more each time I've seen it.
I have too, although I'm still a bit fuzzy about the last 20 minutes. But we'll get to that. Because you guys have DM'd me questions via Twitter. 7 pages of questions. Now, some of them will be covering the same ground, so if we don't get to your question, it's not because it's rubbish, it's because someone else asked something similarly first. Now, we're going to be jumping all over the film with these questions, so I will say, before we get into the discussion, this is a spoiler podcast, so if you haven't seen Wonder Woman, then highly to your nearest cinema, check out the movie, and then come back and listen to the podcast. Sounds good. All right, here we go. 7 pages of questions. Where should we go? Here we go. Random order. With a David Thewlis question from Mostalica. Did a CGI augmented mustache wearing David Thewlis work for you as a physical incarnation of war? Also, if Wonder Woman, here we get into it. If Wonder Woman was an MCU movie, where would you rank it? Two for one from Mostalica. All right, let's take the David Thewlis question first. What do we think? What do we think of Thewlis as Ares, god of war?
It was a terrible experiment.
It was just a question of which of you was going to use that phrase.
Yeah. Dr. Moran, you terrible experiment. I will say one thing about this movie. It was great. It actually reintroduced me to my David Thewlis impression. So that's good.
Thank goodness for that.
This was my biggest bugbear with the film, actually. He works in the role as it begins, and then it's that bit where you see him as Ares in classical Grecian times, and it pans down to a fucking porn stash sporting Thewlis freshly fallen from Olympus, and you're just like, really?
I have an important question. Is that actually Thewlis's upper body beneath that face?
I imagine Thewlis has never seen an upper body like that.
He's not, what's that? Pectorals? I don't know what they are.
I would like to suggest a crazy, geeky point at this point. Sir Patrick Morgan could be a reference to the Irish goddess of war, who's the Morrigan.
No.
And I would like to think that's the case.
No.
Look,
way.
I choose to think that they were that clever in the name. Shut up.
Should they not, let's be honest, have morphed him into another actor? At the point where you discover he is the all-powerful god of war.
Isn't there a danger there that you morph him into, like, you know, someone who is not The Rock but looks like The Rock, but then that person is a less good actor than David Thewlis, and then everyone complains about that? I think that is genuinely your sort of danger there.
But CG-augmented Thewlis is no more impressive than non-augmented Thewlis.
There's just a bit when you're sat there and I was like, I know I'm meant to be taking this seriously, and I enjoyed the first 2 acts so much, and I kind of want to shut my eyes and pretend this isn't happening because the sheer absurdity of it, and you're trying to reconcile, and as you say, you know, you believe him originally, and then you're like, you can't, oh my God, he's meant to be the god of war. Oh my God, he's meant to be the god of war. And he's meant to be seducing her to the dark side. That is meant to be,
it's
such as his power.
It goes Jedi at that point, doesn't it?
It does go Jedi.
Come Come and work with me, Diana, as we says.
The big way of things were attaching to him, and he was becoming this all-powerful thing, and the moustache was still poking through, and his eyes were still coming through.
The tash is at least, because I was a Twitter follower, wrote about this, Kate McDonald, hello Kate, wrote a big piece on all the sort of anachronisms in the film. His moustache is not one of the anachronisms. That is period.
That's
perfect.
That's solid.
That is solid. That is there.
Solid. I think Stewlis was wedded to the tash. He went, I'm not fucking losing it. I don't want to lose it, you cheeky monkey. So I'm keeping it. There, of course, are other questions that spin off from Stewlis and Ares. We are starting with the end of the film. But this was the big downer of the movie for me. The fact that the first two-thirds of this movie, not even the first two-thirds, the first 2 hours of this movie are fantastic. I loved it, and I was floating on air, and I had a big goofy grin on my face, as I say in the Empire Review. And honestly, at one point, I was kind of leaning towards 5 stars with this movie because I thought it was doing everything right. And then David bloody Stewlis turns up as the god of war, monologues for a bit, and then turns into a shit Magneto, and it turns into a big CGI punch-a-thon that doesn't catch fire.
I think the big problem for me actually watching it, so the third time I watched it was on Sunday, which was after, not to bring the mood down horrendously, after the London attacks, and everything they say in that scene really rang true to me that morning, because it just felt really much more powerful in a horrible way. I think the big problem is maybe the design. The design is terrible because everything he's saying and the sort of the emotional intensity of that scene is actually pretty good. It's just what you're watching doesn't work.
As a villain, because he's not, if you remember, he is trying to expose a truth about humanity, right? Yeah. And that truth about humanity is it's riddled with hypocrisy and that this darkness lives within us. And he whispers in people's ears. That's what he does. And that kind of seduction element I thought was really interesting. And obviously that's what she then wrangles with, which is, you know, actually humanity is flawed and it's problematic and people aren't always good and there is evil within the world and all of those. And I really liked all of those themes. But he was just rendered terribly. Like, it was farcical, and that undercuts the really great stuff that's happening from a thematic perspective.
He was reduced to saying things like, I will destroy you, and it's just, oh really?
If he's just like, let's imagine for a moment they hadn't put him in any armor. Mm-hmm. He'd still been like throwing big things at her, so she still has to deal with stuff, but he's just standing there in quite a cool coat. Would that work better?
Yes, I think it would have been more intelligent. I think if you're going to position Ares as actually sort of the whisperer, sort of like pouring poison in people's ears. However, if you're going to have him armored and attacking Wonder Woman, it's a different archetype. That doesn't work. You can't suddenly clad him in steel and have him sort of hurling things.
Yeah.
I think pick one or the other. It would have been more nuanced if he'd been more sort of cerebral and less physical.
Well, I actually think, and we talked about this the second time we saw it, did it need an Ares at all? Did it need the God of War twist? Could it have been that there was no God of War and that mankind is just this fucked up instrument that just has good and bad, and we're inclined to war without David Thewlis pushing us towards it?
That's more morally interesting, but I think that almost, it makes the Wonder Woman character slightly more farcical because it just makes her seem like an idiot. Whereas I think it's quite interesting the way we think she's an idiot and everyone thinks she's an idiot, but actually it turns out she's right all along.
I don't know if it does make her an idiot. It makes her, she has this belief in Ares, and then the fact that if she comes to realization that there is no Ares, where he was defeated years ago, or it's just a fairy tale. After all, this is a movie where she gets lied to constantly, from the beginning, she's lied to again and again and again. I think that would have been an interesting point in her development as a person had this Ares not turned out to be real. The problem, of course, is that she's so powerful that they needed something for her to fight on a similar power level, and that's a problem with all these movies.
It's a problem with Superman. It has been for all these years. And it's a big, big issue. And it's going to be a big, big issue for Justice League. Because if you have problems coming up with a bad guy for Superman or Wonder Woman on their own, well, good news, guys. There's more of them.
Yeah. And isn't that point in her development, isn't that dealt with by the God Killer sword? Because ultimately, you know, she thinks that is the thing that kills gods. But obviously what she finds out is that she is the God Killer, and that strength from her is within. So I think it's really handy for there to be something for her to kind of bounce off and have that realisation. I think the battle was just handled terribly, and it was very much a BVS kind of kind of battle with
without
things going on. There was one shot, there was one aerial shot, which I'm pretty sure was actually just BVS, kind of like with a different colour thing put on, treatment put over the top. So it, for me, it really helped that there was something that a physical thing, person, whatever we're calling yeah. him, which enabled her to kind of accelerate that journey and have that realisation about her power as a woman, but also as a demigod.
Mm. And also, once she kills Ludendorff, her role in the film stops. She stops at that moment, and there's a moment we'll talk about later on, I think, where she has this moment of doubt and weakness when she's confronted by Steve, and Steve says, help, help. And it feels a little bit out of character for me with Diana's response. But at that moment, she would just stop, and Steve's story would continue, and he'd be off, you know, getting on the plane and stuff, and she'd just be standing on a roof going, I am not sure what I'd do anymore. So they needed something yes. for her to do. But I wonder if that maybe was something that they could have fixed in the scripting stage.
A random thing that stuck with me while watching that, which is just, I couldn't work out why they'd included this. So when she kills him, she leaves the sword embedded in the corpse.
Yep. Mm.
And then when she faces off against Ares, she reaches for it and it isn't there. And then the next shot is just of her ankles as she plops back down, having presumably gone up to retrieve
yep.
it. And that just seemed like, why? Why leave it? Why have that in there? It seemed a very peculiar little thing.
I was worried when she left the sword in there, so I was glad that they showed her actually. Yeah, I was glad that they showed her actually dealing with it. But I guess he wasn't worried. He didn't have to stop her getting it because he wasn't scared by it.
No, I just found it an odd thing because if it was going to be a thing, make it a thing, and if it's not a thing, why have it in the movie? Take it with you.
I think at that point you're still supposed to think it is a thing.
It's a basic thing. If you have a weapon, you don't put it down.
Who saw the God Killer twist coming, and who saw the Thewlis twist coming? I remember Nick Decembly leaned over to me about halfway through and went,
it's Thewlis.
It's Thewlis, isn't it? It's Thewlis. I went, yes.
Well, in
yes,
fairness, I guessed from the synopsis they gave me on set, and I talked Nick through everything I knew on set. So that may have been in the back of his mind.
It was blatantly obvious. I tweaked it the second he walked on. Also, he was being so shifty.
He was in Lupin mode. He was in nice guy mode.
He was, and he clearly had his own agenda. Yeah. I'm going to help you for no obvious reason. No, it was, yes, very, very, very telegraphed.
You'll need to watch more Harry Potter.
How do you have David Thewlis in your movie and not decapitate him? That's just the one thing I'm going to say. The man's been decapitated on screen more than anyone else, pretty much. So just lop the head off. Tash and all. Right, second part of this question from Mustelica. If Wonder Woman was an MCU movie, where would you rank it?
That's problematic.
It's somewhere pretty close to Captain America the First Avenger, if I'm honest.
Okay. We're top five?
That is top five for me, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, I said it.
What's wrong with you?
I love it.
It's a very good film. It's a very good film, James.
What, the First Avenger?
Yeah. Wildly underrated film.
Yeah.
Wildly.
Yeah, it's fine. Just not as good as most of their other
films. Given that, this movie is Captain America the First Avenger for the most part, with a lot of Superman and a little bit of Thor, and a little bit of Monica.
No, I think this is, yes, I think this is better than the First Avenger. I don't think it's on a par with...
Doesn't have a musical number.
No, it doesn't.
That's
more's
true.
The pity. I don't think it's like on a par with the top tier Marvel movies. But I think it's a solid sort of upper middle tier one.
Okay.
I'm pretty happy with it.
I think ultimately we can't, although I did love this film, I think the last half an hour is caused some serious harm for me in just how much I did love it, and I think that makes it really difficult to argue against some of, you know, a lot of the Marvel, you know, think about Captain America, it's just so brilliantly executed from top to bottom, and there were such significant flaws in the last half an hour of this film. I think that makes it really problematic. Can somebody just remake the last half an hour and just do us all a massive favour?
In many ways, its treatment of the war is arguably a little problematic. Do you know what I mean? The way it kind of resolves to the hugging and the, oh, look, let's all be friends. I don't know. I found that quite uncomfortable.
This is the war where the two sides played football against each other at Christmas.
Very true. Yes. Very true.
So, I know what you mean, but I don't care.
And rightly so.
Most Helen O'Hara comment yet.
True.
I feel like yeah, you can absolutely, and the tweeter I mentioned has done a great piece picking apart its treatment of the war, deservedly so. You know, she is ultimately killing conscripted men who probably don't want to be there when she attacks the trenches and goes through the Belgian town, there are lots of things that wouldn't make sense, like German High Command being just behind the front on the Belgian border and having lots of invited guests in fancy costumes come to join them there, because the fighting continued right up until the last minute, you know. So that seems a bit odd. But at the same time, like thematically and in terms of the storytelling, none of that really bothered me so much.
I thought it would bother people more than it did. I wrote a line in my review that the fact that it does detour into World War One, and it does not just World War One, but No Man's Land and the front and, you know,
mustard gas.
Essentially war crimes. I thought that might have caused some issues. And yes, there have been some people who've had some problems with it. But by and large, it's a little bit like Indiana Jones fighting the Nazis in those movies, or Steve Rogers fighting Nazis on Hydra in The First Avenger, or, you know, Blackadder, a comedy set in World War One. You know, although I did want to see Field Marshal Haig, Lady Haig, and their tortoise, Alan. It's a shame.
And I do think that the fact that Ares was British, as it were, does detract somewhat from the comparisons to World War II, because she's coming at it like it's World War II, actually. And she's coming at it like the Germans are just the bad guys. That's what she's been told by Steve, which is what he believes, and he has no reason to really believe otherwise.
I've lost count the number of times I've seen people say the word Nazis in regard to this movie, because people don't know.
And both sides were, I mean, I think we can all agree now we're past Versailles Treaty, but like both sides were equally to blame for World War One, and we can get past the War Guilt Clause and all of that history. I just don't think that, I think the fact that Ares did turn out to be on the British side does somewhat undermine all of those kind of criticisms, because it does show that it was both sides.
And also, I have to say, I think the moment that she does cross into No Man's Land is a fantastic moment.
Super,
I think it's
amazing.
Really well judged. The action sequence that follows afterwards, because it's a very interesting thing about Diana's progression throughout the movie, and I'm sure you guys noticed as well, but the fact that, you know, it's about her learning, and it's about her beginning to trust in her own abilities and her own powers and along the way. And that's the first moment I feel that she is beginning to really explore what she can do. And it's a really triumphant moment. And the fact that I think Patty Jenkins handles the tone shifts really well in this film. The tone shift from Themyscira. Am I saying that wrong?
Themyscira.
Themyscira. Themyscira. I've only seen the movie three times. Themyscira, Paradise Island. So the shift in tone from there to London, which is more comedic, and then the shift to the front, and where you see, which I thought was really bold and brave, the effect that it has on the people who fought in the war. And you see that, you know, when you know, the soldiers come towards are injured, there's a bloke with his leg off at one point. Ewan Bremner's character has PTSD, essentially. I thought it was really interesting. And then in the middle of that, to have the courage to have a full-on superhero striding across No Man's Land, deflecting bullets with her incredible bracelets and just being generally awesome. Really brave, and I think she pulled it off.
Well, she had to fight for that scene's inclusion, but I agree, I think it's really important. There's a great line, and I'm sorry, I don't remember where I read it, but it was, if you want to stop an asteroid, you call Superman. If you want to solve a mystery, you call Batman. But if you want to end a war, you call Wonder Woman. And that scene is what really sells that side of her character, that she is a warrior who is adamantly opposed to war, and that is the scene that shows that that's what she was built to do, essentially.
Mm. Also, that feels like that's the bit where her agency comes to the fore, because since they leave the island, Steve's been kind of calling the shots and the directions, and at that point she just says no, and she refuses to go along with him, and she's like, yes, I understand what you're saying about the broader strategic objectives, but this is a human problem, I have the solution, and I'm going to go and kill some people. Well, not kill them, but you know what I mean, go out there, and she wants to make a difference, she wants to save these people, and even if the laws of physics are temporarily suspended at that point, I really liked it. That was a proper, like, adrenaline pumping, rousing, get up and, you know, punch the air type moment.
I think I said to you, Chris, like, the only thing I wish is the music kicks it. Obviously, I was surprised at how little the music is actually used in this film. And it kicked in at the scene afterwards. So I was expecting it when she kind of goes over the top. That's when I was expecting it to kick in, because exactly that moment, that is the moment she becomes Wonder Woman, and she's no longer Diana, and that is such a magic moment. And yes, physics are suspended, although we were talking about a Wired piece about the science of her bracelets, which I will be reading this evening, but it's the one afterwards where she goes full action, she crashes through the window and the music kicks in, and that's obviously meant to signify and symbolise that this is her becoming, and she is now Wonder Woman.
I think the judicious use of that electric cello was well thought, because they could have really, really hammered that. But I agree with you. I think I would have liked to have seen it the second she goes over the top for her big push. That's when I'd like to have heard it.
I don't think that would have worked.
Yeah, I think tonally, I think it would have been out there. There are echoes of that melody in there, but I don't think... Rest if you'd gone straight in at that, I think it would have been weird.
Well, I suppose because really she's just running at that point, not...
Also, that's a very propulsive, very driving piece of music, and I think she's walking in slow motion. That doesn't... For me, it wouldn't quite work.
You need to shoot it slightly differently, I think.
But I think that theme is fantastic. I know it defied people. I've had some people on my Twitter feed say they absolutely hated it when it came into the movie, but I think it's great. And I think it's really interesting. Lots of superheroes have themes. She's the only superhero I can think of who has an instrument. I mean, you can play Superman's theme on anything. You could play it on, like, you know, Glockenspiel if you wanted to. You could play Batman's theme, any of them, on different instruments as well. But that's an instrument, and that really chimes, and I think it really works. Should we have a second question?
We're going super well here.
Christ. At Franco Palmer asks, did any of you tear up / nearly cry, and at what point in the movie? I didn't cry, of course, says Franco Palmer, and then says, honest. Which leads me to believe, Franco Palmer, you're a liar, and you did cry.
I will say, literally what we've just been talking about, I did feel myself welling up slightly when she went over the top. I found myself feeling very emotionally overwhelmed at that point because I think it's just very poignant. And I think if you read a lot about the First World War and, you know, the significance of what going over the top traditionally meant, i.e. mass slaughter and suicide, I just thought it was a very powerful moment. So, yes, that was my slightly teary moment.
Wow, okay, cool.
Me too. Also, just the mascara at the beginning. Also, the end where she just... leaps off the Louvre. That was awesome. Just generally.
The Louvre.
Yeah.
Not the Louvre.
Yeah. But I was like, was this a credits thing that I missed? Wonder Woman having a wee and then, no.
So I did full cry when Robin Wright died.
Yes, that too.
And that moment, and I loved the stuff. I don't know if this is actually a gender-specific thing, because Helen's probably the only other person I've spoken to who found the first kind of half an hour super emotional. I found it really touching, that kind of community of women and the relationships between them, and then when she is obviously shot by the Germans, that bit was actually like... ripped my soul out. And I found that death scene 100 times more emotional than Steve's supposed, we presume, death scene at the end.
Yeah.
And that for me, and what actually, one of the things I found disappointing, this is jumping forward slightly, one of the things I found disappointing about the film is when she summons the kind of love within her to be able to win the war at the end, it's the love she has for Steve that is kind of the thing that fuels her. And that actually really irritated me because I thought it should have been the love of other women and the love of sisterhood and the love for her aunt, who just basically sacrificed herself for you. That should have been the thing that drove her. These are women who've raised her, who've committed their life to her, who've spent their lives trying to protect her and train her.
But she's bored with them. That's what, you know, she spent hundreds of years, if not thousands, with them. And then this guy comes along and he's exciting and fresh.
And look at that hair, man.
Yeah, it's definitely above average. The other thing about the scene at the beginning, the battle scene with Antiope, her grin when she goes, like, everything Robin Wright does in that scene is 100% perfect. Like, it is so good. And her grin in that scene is just amazing. And you can see a direct line from that to Wonder Woman in Batman v Superman.
There's the moment where she does the shield thing and she leaps over the three German soldiers. And there's that amazing shot of her in slow motion turning around and firing the three arrows at the German guys. I turned to my wife and said, imagine that being the last thing you see. You'd almost die happy. Being like, okay, I've been killed by a goddess. I'm fine. It's all right, guys.
Yeah.
I thought, it's interesting because I think those characters, that scene, that whole segment for me is analogous to the Krypton segment in Superman the movie. Mm. And then moving to, you know, our hero moves to planet Earth, quote unquote. And I think it does a similar job. It doesn't blow up in the same way, obviously, that Krypton does. But they have very limited time to get those character types across and those archetypes across in the same way that Marlon Brando, Susanna York had with the Krypton moments. And I think they do a really, really good job of it.
God, yeah.
But the point you make about the emotion that Diana feels when Steve dies and not when Antiope dies is, I think it's very much a tradition going back to Star Wars. You know, Luke doesn't get upset when his aunt and uncle who've raised him die. He gets upset when the old bloke he's just met gets
literally met
off
like a day ago.
Yeah. So yeah, it's fine. But for me, I came close to tearing up with when Steve died because of the last shot. The last shot of Chris Pine in the airplane, looking back, knowing his life is about to end, and presumably the last thing that enters his head is thoughts of Diana. And he has a lovely little smile on his face at the end. I thought it was very, very moving.
She rocked his world.
Have you never had that experience where you've met someone and just like instantly just fallen for them? I mean, I don't know if I have.
Never.
I mean, do we think he's dead? No, because nobody stays dead in comics.
He has to be.
There were rumors that he signed up for more than one film. Well, no, there are a few options for ways we could see him again, okay? Number one, somebody like Eris snatched him from the jaws of death. Probably unlikely. Number two, flashbacks. Super likely. Number three, like great-great-grandnephew, which I think the TV show did something like that, didn't it?
It'll be like Captain America getting with the niece of his long love. Yeah. Oh, my God. Icky. Ooh.
But what about Parachute?
There was certainly a rumor that he'd signed for more than one film. So
I imagine that was just to distract us.
Maybe. Or it's just contractual, depending on what it gives them options, doesn't it?
It gives them options. Yeah. But I imagine one of the appeals of this role for Chris Pine, apart from the fact that it's a really good role, is it's a one and done.
Yeah,
and, you know, as Kirk, he was signed on to three, and that does dominate your life. These movies dominate your life. They dominate our lives, for the love of God. Imagine what it's like if you're in them. And I imagine this is like this. I get to go in, I get to do really, really cool stuff, and then I get to do other movies? Yes. Where do I sign? Thank you.
I think it's also good that he did sign up, because I think a lot of films led by women with a woman's name in the title have struggled to get decent male co-stars. I mean, Erin Brockovich had a pre-stardom Aaron Eckhart opposite Julia Roberts, whereas Julia Roberts plays second fiddle to Tom Hanks or George Clooney. Do you know what I mean? There's a massive imbalance there. And so I think it's really, really good that he was in this to begin with.
Yarp. Right. That's just Rich asks, how happy are you that didn't make Chris Pine, Steve Trevor out to be a Wayne?
That would be weird.
He's Steve.
Yeah.
We just talk about Steve. Like, this is my other problem.
His name's Steve.
His name is Steve.
Steve Trevor.
And I'm trying really hard, but as we're sat around talking about Steve.
You realise you've alienated every listener whose name
is Steve.
Sorry,
anybody whose name
Steve.
Is Steve.
Nothing wrong with Steve.
Steve.
Gummy bears. There's nothing wrong with Steve. Steve's fine.
Steve gave his life to save the day so she could save the world, the planet. Like, I can't. It's Steve. Sorry, that's Steve. A massive distraction, but it's bothered me.
It's good enough for Captain America.
Yep, Steve Rogers.
Alan. Yep. What about
Clive.
Yeah.
Oh. Keith.
Steve Rogers Trevor.
No. Yeah.
At Helen Dynamite asks, hang on, there's a different Helen, and she's also Dynamite. Wow. A couple of questions here from Helen Dynamite. Given this a record-breaking film with a female director and female action lead, can we forget Ghostbusters ever happened? I don't think we need to. I like that film. Mm-hmm. Number two, I found it a bit weird when WW strode out into no man's land and basically slaughtered a load of Nazis in lingering slow motion in order to stop the violence. Thoughts? I think we've covered that.
They weren't Nazis.
They weren't Nazis.
Yeah, it's also, just to say on that question, it's not a quid pro quo. It's not like all films with women in need to kind of be judged against each other.
True. And she doesn't really direct her efforts at the soldiers in that scene. Does she throw the shield or something at the machine gun? But she doesn't initial, like, her target is not necessarily to kill as many people as possible. I mean, she does kill a bunch of people.
She really does.
She's not like, screw you guys. She's more like, I will get through this.
The overkill of the moment when she takes out the sniper is quite this poor guy, again, imagine that being the last thing you see. It's like, oh, great. But kind of happy at the same time. Question three, do you think this will have any influence at all on how the love interests in future superhero films will be written? Steve has loads to do and is capable of doing it, is arguably the braver of the two with his sacrifice. Could this lead to Lois Lane getting more to do next time around than just dropping a stick in a pond?
That would be nice. I mean, he's basically Agent Carter. They've essentially written Agent Carter there and called her Steve Trevor.
Yeah. I mean, I think the relationship is more Lois Clark than it is Steve Peggy, but, you know.
Yeah, he's a bit funnier, I guess, than Peggy is. Well, although she can be very funny.
Anyway. She can be very funny, but
I think
it is.
In terms of changing love interests, it may change I think if anything, it will change supporting male actors' roles, but I don't think it will. I don't see it as a Love Actress. I think more, you've got a male supporting actor who gets to do heroic things, but also is very much the equal of her. We talked, Helen and I were talking about this on Twitter, which is their relationship is amazing because there's parity and there's, you know, he doesn't have to become weak to make her or to allow her to be stronger. They both have a role to play. And when he does say, you know, what does he say? I'll save today and you save
the
world or tomorrow, whatever. Yeah. That, you know, they the world, understand their roles in it and they are both strong and they both have functions to play. But this is her destiny and this is her show. So I think that's an exciting thing in terms of male supporting actors or male love interests, like just in and of itself, a male love interest.
It's a super dreamy relationship, honestly.
It really is, right? Right from the get-go, you have this moment where he wakes up and he sees this goddess and he's just gone from that moment.
Is that shot taken from The Little Mermaid? Was I the only one who thought of The Little Mermaid at that moment?
Which shot?
Where she's sort of kneeling over him on the beach. It's 100% Prince Eric and Ariel.
Really?
I think.
I don't remember that.
When he's just drowned, pretty much.
Yeah, because she drags him out of the water and she's finishing off singing the sort of little bit of Part of Your World or something. I don't know. And
I think the movie handles her relationship really, really well. I think they're both fantastic. I love the scene in the boat with all the business about why don't you sleep with me? And I've read the 12 volumes about bodily pleasure and the pleasures of the flesh. And he's like, did you bring one of those with you?
Men are essential for procreation, but when it comes to pleasure, unnecessary. Which I thought was a good line.
Yeah. Big laughs from the women in the house at that one. Not so many from the men.
It's really funny.
One of the reviewers referred to that as an inexplicable line in the film, which I thought was quite telling.
Because he thought Themyscira was, and I quote, sexless. Which is, I mean, there are pretty explicit relationships, actually, if you're actually paying attention to those scenes. Antiope's deputy is clearly not just her deputy. She runs over in absolute devastation when Antiope is killed. And she's treated very much as sort of one of the family.
It's just procreation that is unnecessary because they're basically immortal.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hey ho.
But they can have sexual pleasure without men and penis. I'm looking at you and you have no idea what I'm talking about.
That's the representative of penises, right? Okay, fine.
Oh, I'm not. Yeah, no, fair enough. Fair enough. Here's my question for the Wonder Woman podcast. How do you guys, this is from the @TheBoxSurfer, who's actually one of the people who I had a discussion with on Twitter that helped us do this. How do you guys think the DCU intends to reconcile the characterization of Diana Prince in this film and Batman Superman going forward? It feels like Zack Snyder deliberately made her cynical to fit with his worldview in Batman Superman, while her portrayal in Wonder Woman is far from this. I actually think they paint themselves into a corner a little bit with the whole Batman Superman thing.
I think that they are going to more or less totally retcon that and just ignore it. I think that, I mean, certainly from what she said when we were interviewing her for this film, they sort of realised as they went along that she could never completely lose her faith in humanity. And that's sort of what they'd portrayed in Batman versus Superman. And they sort of realised, no, that doesn't fit the character. It doesn't fit the story we're telling, but it also just doesn't fit the character at all.
Yeah.
And I think what we're going to see in Justice League is a sort of a very softly, softly redux of that whole idea. So I don't know how they'll explain where or what she was doing in the meantime. I don't know that they necessarily have to. I mean, they could leave that open for future films. We could see a WW2:WW2. But I don't know that they're going to deal with it. I think
you want to end
a
war, you get Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
So people will wonder, why didn't she end World War II or the Vietnam War or any of the many genocides that have happened on the planet?
I mean, she could have gone back to Themyscira in between for a while, for example, and been unaware of them.
Can't she go back? Someone said that she can't.
Well, the wording is confusing, isn't it? Because her mother says, you may never come back.
You may never come back. And I couldn't work out if she was trying to warn her, essentially. Oh, she's not going to want her to go and fight Ares because then she may actually discover the truth about her, you know, parentage. Mm. And so I read that very much as maybe she wouldn't want to come back, or she'd choose not to come back, or humanity would change her so much that she'd be unable to come back. And that's what I struggle with at the end, is why she wouldn't just go back. And then obviously, there's 100 years between that and BVS. And in BVS, she says, you know, she left humanity behind because men made a world where standing together is impossible. So my question is, what happened in those 100 years? It feels like something else must have happened if they're going to stick with that characterization in BVS, because it can't be the death of Steve, because she ends the film on a really positive note, and she chooses, she's suffered this loss, but she chooses to believe in humanity and choose love and do the right thing. So what has happened in the meantime, which has sent her into exile, which is what you presume after watching BBS has happened for the last 100 years, is she's in self-imposed exile. But what has driven her to that?
So they could adapt The Circle or something, or one of the Themyscira set comics, to maybe explain that. Could be quite cool.
See, I kind of wonder if that's why they have that moment that I had an issue with, where she kills Danny, not the Red Skull. She kills, not the Red Skull. He's absolutely not the Red Skull. She kills him, and then she has that moment where she realizes he's not Ares, and it's everything she thought was her purpose is actually not the case. Yeah. And so she has this moment of weakness where Steve comes and goes, look, the war is still happening and people are going to die. Come and help me. And she refuses. And I had an issue with that. And I wonder, though, if that's what they were trying to set up. They were trying to reconcile that Diana with the Diana of BVS, who has stood by for many, many years and let terrible things happen, you know, wars and the libertines and all sorts of terrible bans just happen. And she's, I just wonder if that might be something that they were going for there. Mm. But then she's got innate decency and goodness, and then she immediately turns around again. Where would you go next? A lot of people have asked where they should take the character next. There's been talk about whether the sequel will be contemporary and set after the events of Justice League, or whether they'll go into World War II, although that would really set the Captain America alarm bells ringing. Or, you know, does she fight in the 60s? Does she take on the Beatles? What does she do?
I would watch Wonder Woman versus the Beatles.
The Ringo of Truth versus the Lesser of Truth. It'd be amazing.
I genuinely don't know. I think we probably are going to be looking at a contemporary set story. I think that's just probably what's going to happen. So I'm intrigued to see how that plays out and how they do explain the middle. If she has been back on Themyscira, then you still get to play some of that fish out of water stuff if she emerges back into the modern world. So there might be a temptation to do it that way and to explain it that way, I guess. I don't really know, though. That's helpful, isn't it?
I would love another period piece in the middle because I enjoyed that aspect of Wonder Woman much more than I thought I would. Even from the trailers, I was like, I'm not really sure about this. I loved her in contemporary and BVS, but I just wasn't feeling it. And I loved it. And the stuff on Themyscira, I just absolutely loved that stuff. And I would love to see more of it. And I suppose for the BVS characterization to be legitimate and authentic, to have some kind of story which really explains what she has been doing and why she has, as you say, chosen to sit out those atrocities and those wars. Because you really believe in her and you believe that ultimately she will, even if she does refuse initially, you feel that ultimately she really wants to do the right thing and really believes in the power of love and the decency of humanity. So it feels weird to me to not explore that bit in the middle, which may explain some of that. That's what keeps me up at night, is that bit specifically, is why she's chosen to sit out in the way she has.
At Colin Best, 1978, asks, do Steve and Diana board a magical boat that allows them to travel from Themyscira, which is somewhere in the Mediterranean, we're guessing,
yeah,
to London
Eastern Mediterranean,
overnight.
I'm guessing, because he's flying from Turkey.
Yeah, and that's not a plane that flies a long distance, the one he's in.
No, exactly. So it's Eastern Mediterranean, so close to Turkey.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would, yes, seem to be an awfully long way to go in one night. I picked this up with you, Chris, and you reckoned...
I don't think it's one night. I think they take several days to get there, and it's a magical cut.
And they get that little bit of help at the end with the tugboat giving them a pull. But otherwise, it's just been some time that we didn't see.
Just said
maybe
a sentence with the word tug and pull in it, and I am not reacting.
Is he the first man ever to find...
Well, yes, but I mean, some of the languages that they can speak, right, wouldn't have existed when they went into, you know, isolation. So presumably, there somebody who can go on and off the island and trade for books and things? I feel like there should be, but that hasn't been explained or explored at all. So maybe it doesn't exist.
I've heard it's notoriously difficult to find, especially for men, but but he found it. Yes, I agree. I agree with Helen's theory.
Yeah, thank you.
This fictional Themyscira of which you talk. At OB08, do you think the sword is actually important, or was it always intended they would tell Diana it was the weapon and it was put on a pedestal for that purpose? Also, why did Bruce Wayne need to send a picture via armoured truck?
Yeah, WhatsApp would have been fine.
He's Bruce Wayne. He's known for overkill, let's be honest.
Yeah, WhatsApp's private, right? Somebody was telling me.
It's end-to-end encrypted.
Encrypted, yeah, just checking. Carry on.
I'm just going to jump in with... I have issues with Connie Nielsen's logic. So the whole point is she doesn't want to tell her what she is because that will make Ares find her sooner, which we can gloss over the fact that that makes no coherent sense whatsoever. But if we're assuming that Ares is going to find her, then not training her to fight makes even less sense because she'd be absolutely helpless when he in fact discovered her. So surely from the moment she was born, she should have been turned into a ninja.
Well, that's Antiope's.
Yes, yeah. And she happens to be right. Yeah. But I just that whole thing irked me slightly.
Well, maybe it's that, maybe there's a sort of a prophecy, that the wording of which we're not familiar with. Maybe that would be handy. Maybe Ares finding her depends on her fulfilling her fate as an Amazon, for example. So she doesn't become an Amazon, then she's absolutely totally fine.
Because she's on an island full of warrior women, so she would be the world's biggest fifth wheel, completely useless, contributing nothing. It's a slightly odd...
There are senators as well.
I bet they kick ass, though.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Is it not part of her mum's denial, though, as well? Like, this sense of wanting to keep her in the dark about who she really is and what her destiny is, and she doesn't want her to fulfil that destiny.
I think it feels true. Like
we all have secrets and shame, James, in our families, and this, for me, is just, a version of that.
Okay, I still think it's problematic. That struck me as a little bit of woolly plotting that maybe could have been thought through a little better. Just saying.
Well, of course, Ares doesn't find her. She walks into his office.
Just,
hello! Hi! Okay, so this is from @DisEuphoriaFilm. Is it not quietly remarkable that Ewan Bremner's Charlie, set up as a crack sharpshooter with PTSD, has his redemption not by making some nigh on impossible amazing shot, but by his ability to sing and play the piano? Emblematic of the film's humanitarian ethos.
Yeah, I think it's nice that it doesn't gloss over the effect of war. I think it's nice that you have, the chief there, first of all, speaking apparently the proper Blackrock dialect and claiming to be Nappy the trickster god, which I thought was very cool. But also he's talking about Steve's people not being so blameless either. I think that gives you a level of, sort of complexity. I think it's really good that Saeed Taghmoui is talking about racism to her. And I was actually surprised. I think there should have been a bit more shock on her face at that point, because that's obviously not something that exists where she comes from. But I like that introduced a little tiny bit of nuance to it, and it wasn't the traditional this guy can't sharpshoot, but now he can, so that's good. He's got his symbolic penis back. I think it was great that we didn't actually go that route.
James, where's your symbolic penis?
I don't even know how to answer that question.
But do you think I was
next
worried
to his symbolics?
I was worried that what? Oh, very good.
Yes, that would have been a better answer.
Sorry. I was worried that Americans wouldn't understand his accent at all.
Yeah, didn't Trainspotting have to have subtitles back in the day?
Yes,
so.
It did. Americans, tell us if you could understand him.
Loved Samir, by the way. I love that scene where they're talking in different languages to each other. Yeah. Very, very funny. NC Lowe asks, should all comic book Steves be banned from planes from now on? Yes.
Yes.
Don't go in there. A couple of questions. This is stuff that lots of people have asked, but... Carton Attlee asked this one first. Ludendorff apparently is a real person. And is it wrong that a real-life German general is turned into an over-the-top cartoonish villain in the film? Is that rather distracting? Is it in some way, I guess, historically weird? Is it even disrespectful to someone who is admittedly fighting on the bad team?
I don't know. I hadn't thought of that. I didn't realise he was a real person until now. So,
yeah. Several people sent me links. I don't know whether it's meant to be the same or whether it's just a coincidence, but they obviously do clear these names. They do check these things out when they're making these movies. So it can't be a coincidence, right? I mean, the real Ludendorff obviously wasn't killed by a goddess.
No, but he did join up with the Nazis and then promulgate the theory of total war, she
that
said,
is
looking
some
at Wikipedia.
Cracking Googling.
So I feel like if we're gonna defame somebody, let's defame the Nazi. I'm okay with that. Okay.
I suppose I'm confused about why you would need to base that kind of character
up
on a real life person.
Yeah.
It's, if you're gonna, there are kind of plenty of, I presume, OTT characterization of Nazis you can dream up as writers. I think it's maybe just a little bit odd, and I don't know what the motivation would be behind actually doing that.
Hey, Marvel, this is a real person and in no way the Red Skull. Perhaps it's that.
Maybe it is that, James.
Possibly, possibly. Again, a question asked by several people, but this time from Isaac Moreno. Basically asking about the fact that Ares is real, and at the end of the movie, when he dies, everyone does seem to suddenly break out of a spell and they're all friends again and the war ends, which is not what I took the movie to be saying. I took the movie to be saying that even though he exists, the darkness is within us. So what do we make of the end where everyone's suddenly happy, clappy friends again?
Well, first of all, I was confused by the timeline there, because as she comes into camp, night has just fallen, and then she has a short fight with Ludendorff and a short fight with Ares, and then the sun comes up. So, I mean, it's meant to be November, so that seems like awfully, awfully quick. I think that, yeah, I think you're probably right. There is a little bit of an inconsistency there, because they do become good men again, as Diana sort of talks about, and all kind of hug as if a spell has been broken. I guess the idea is that they were artificially amped up by Ares, and so that's been kind of keeping the fighting as intense as it was. And maybe because those soldiers have been so close to him during those last few hours, the effect is stronger or something. I don't know. I'm just making up explanations now.
It sounds good to me. I bought it. At Callum H asks, do you lovely people of the pod think this is the start of a change at DC Studios? Will we start to see better films in the DCEU from now on? Someone else asked, would we be happy if they just handed the keys to the kingdom to Patty Jenkins? I kind of feel that I'd be quite happy to see Patty Jenkins just make another Wonder Woman movie and hopefully get a Feige-esque figure in at the top.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be happy for her to do whatever the heck she wants at this point. I think this is a symptom that DC has realised that, you know, grimness all the time is maybe not the way to go. But I think, in fairness to them, I don't think that that's necessarily going to be the case with Justice League either, because certainly all the footage we've seen has been a lot lighter and frothier. Mm. So I don't think it's necessarily confined to Wonder Woman, but I think Wonder Woman is the first great step forward, definitely.
I mean, the first 2 hours, which I loved, just felt like a very singular vision from a filmmaker. It felt like Patty's film. It felt like pretty much anything else, I think, from the DC universe. And that felt really exciting. And actually, when it went off track, I felt like she was moving away from the film. And obviously, we're just presuming. We don't know what went on when the film was actually edited and finished. But the bits where you could really feel Patty on screen, and it was very much a female filmmaker with a very specific point of view, I thought was incredibly exciting. Does that mean she then makes all DC films? No, but I think what she's done for this character in this film and what that says about Wonder Woman going forward and her part in the DC universe is amazingly exciting. Yeah.
I would say Joss Whedon's involvement now in the DCEU probably is going to be a more influencing factor at this point. I mean, it's awful because it's very tragic, the circumstances under which Zack Snyder has stepped away from Justice League. That said, I think kind of a change in governorship of this universe is overdue. So, you know, to what extent Joss will have the ability to reshape Justice League, given that much of it is done, I do not know. And to what extent he will be, you know, a creative director in this going forward, I don't know either. But I would say this film, Patty's involvement in this and Joss's involvement in that, certainly gives me hope that I had not had previously.
Indeed, but I think, you know, Zack Snyder deserves a lot of the credit as well. I think, you know, he cast Gal Gadot. I think clearly he shaped in some way the direction this film was going to go in.
That
I
is
think
true.
It's become a rather obvious thing to do for people to just dismiss Zack Snyder's contribution to the DCEU in general. As for the DCEU going forward, you know, they announced today that there's a possibility Suicide Squad 2 may be happening soon, starting next year. So they've taken all that goodwill.
2 steps back.
I don't know. I mean, I love this film. I think it's fantastic. It's a real step in the right direction after two decent films, the Superman movies, Man of Steel and Batman Superman, not amazing, and one downright awful nonsense. So I don't know. It much depends on Justice League, and I'm intrigued by what James Wan's going to do with Aquaman. I think he's a really interesting director. Mm. So fingers crossed going forward. At Alcorda81 asks, I'm baffled by the lack of blood and the idea that it might hurt the rating. Jurassic Park in 1993 had a PG rating, had some visible bloodshed. Wonder Woman plunges a sword into GL. Who's GL? Oh,
General Ludendorff.
Yes. And not a drop. Lacks credibility, surely.
This is a perennial complaint of mine with PG-13 films, which is where they have all the violence you'd expect from any sort of film, and then they just don't put in blood, and then they can get PG-13. You're absolutely right. There should have been blood on the sword poking through the ceiling, and there wasn't. And that is just what you do to be sure of getting your rating.
Yeah, but then again, if it had been blood, like how many people die in Winter Soldier? Like a lot.
Like a lot. But there also isn't a lot of blood in that.
That's what I'm saying. That's the whole point. But if there was blood, then these would be 15 or 18 rated films.
Exactly.
And that would be you know, defeating the purpose. But watching something like Raiders, even on TV, again, there's lots of blood in that. Even the bits they clearly forget to cut.
But they I'm not sure those would get through now. I'm not even sure Jurassic Park would get through with a...
No. Times have changed. Yeah. Back to Hell and Dynamite, because I've just seen this question. Who had the best hat? I like Robin Wright's helmet because it looked like sideburns.
It's hard to argue with that.
Connie Nielsen's was great. She had that great dress. That was just awesome. Freaking loved her outfits. I really liked Wonder Woman's London outfit. I thought that was really lovely. Genuinely wearable-ish.
She looked amazing, but I did enjoy the fact she was meant to be kind of dowdy and, you know, don't worry, nobody's going to notice you now.
Yeah, Edda Candy, Lucy was great, Lucy Davis, but her line about, oh, well, yeah, now she's not the most beautiful woman you've ever seen because she's wearing glasses, great. Fantastic.
Is she beautiful? I think
you mentioned it, right?
I hadn't noticed.
She's super beautiful. Thank God for Chris Pine being there, or we'd all be turned.
Do you think his head's a weird shape, though?
I mean, yeah.
He's
but
got
I'm,
a head like a 50p piece.
I'm willing to overlook it, though. I'm okay with it.
Has he?
Yeah, you know, like...
it's always in my pocket.
It's like a 50p piece. Look at it. It's weird. And all of his features are confined to about 45% of his face.
Right.
I mean, he's not my top Chris, but he's definitely in the top four.
Who's your top one, Helen?
Evans.
Is number two Helen?
Hemsworth.
Is number three Helen?
Pratt.
Well, at least number five. Laura asks, where the heck was Seuss amongst all this World War One era's madness? Did I miss something? Did he not fancy helping out his good kid in her fight against his bad kid?
He used the last of his strength to set up the walls around Themyscira, so presumably died off at that point.
Yep. Or just...
Or just buggered off.
Or just napping somewhere.
Dad.
And at Psychic Clown, we've talked about it. I mean, the joke, Superman, the first Avenger, but Psychic Clown says, beat for beat, Wonder Woman is basically Captain America, TFA, even down to Steve, a man called Steve, flying to his fate. Yes, and there's a bad German bloke who has an evil scientist as a sidekick and blah, blah, blah. Cap 1 is one of my favourite MCU movies. This is my favourite DC movie, but is it too much of a copy?
No.
Great.
Well, no, just because like you've got Themyscira at the beginning, which is very, very different to World War II Brooklyn, for example.
So yes,
I'll allow it, and a very different character in the middle.
All right. And Goxa Georgina asks, "Do you agree that Steve Trevor is the dreamiest and most amazing male love interest of all time?
Other than having hexagon head."
Yeah. No, 50p head.
Sorry.
There's seven sides to 50p, James.
Yeah. Oh, septagon. Septagon head, sorry.
He is legal tender in many, many shops.
I think he is dreamy just because of the aforementioned equality and the parody between them and the fact that, you know, he doesn't patronise her or be annoying, and that's just dreamy.
But also the relationship, I think, goes to some really interesting places, you know, where she, you know, it's very much that rom-com thing where the lovers can't be allowed to really be together for the final act, so they have to reconcile in some way. There's a little bit of that, but at the same time, there is a sort of ideological conflict, and he is a man who has seen some heinous shit, and they have that confrontation outside Veld when she blames him for essentially all the people dying. It goes to some places I wasn't expecting it to go to.
It does. And I think it's good that I think the idea was that, you know, he has enough cynicism and world knowledge to kind of impart to her to be useful, but she actually, with her idealism, gives some of that to him, and I think he recovers some part of himself as a result of that. And I think that's quite a nice idea. I think that the idea that there's an exchange there, and he's not just mansplaining for the film. He's very much, there's very much an exchange of knowledge and a mutual respect, which is really cool.
Well, and then he's the one who essentially makes her believe in humanity and love again.
Yeah. Oh.
And he gives her the watch.
Aww.
That tiny thing that tells him what to do.
A euphemism.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, let's be honest, like, they definitely did.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, they did, yeah. But I was kind of disappointed. We don't want to see R-rated rutting in a in a superhero film. We don't want to see that. That's, you know, I can't.
That's for your fanfic.
That's for my fanfic. I'm on chapter 3 right now. It's really, really great. But I kind of wanted to see, we had a discussion on Twitter the day about it, you know, like the morning after someone said that where Steve is applying ice to his nether regions, or the building the building they're in shakes and crumbles and falls apart, you know.
There's
because,
other people in there, you monster.
But is that how it works, sex with a god?
Well, we're getting into mole rats territory now.
I was going to say, this is covered quite extensively by Jason Lee.
I don't think Steve would be able to keep up with Diana.
I don't think
he would be able to.
I think I'd have sex with a...
Yeah, no. I mean, I don't want to speculate too much, but I just don't think... I think they'd be able to figure it out.
Yeah.
It's not like sex with a vampire. Do you know what I mean, though? Because the superhuman strength of vampires would hurt you as a mortal, but I'm not sure if that... I think you can control it more as a god, can't you, than a vampire?
Yeah, probably. And she's probably had some, you know, practice back on Themyscira, probably. Ooh. Anyway...
Uh-huh. Okay, a couple of last ones. From CM Grigg, what about Ludendorff? Is there something else to him? Is he just a bloke, or would the strength gas that Dr. Poison gives him work on anybody?
Well, there was a very far-fetched, I thought, theory online that the strength gas could be a sort of precursor way, way back years ago to the gas that then empowers Bane later on, who we know is being talked about again for future Batman adventures. I think that's, let me... say this honestly, like reading way too much into it, but there is that theory out there that it could be in some way related.
Neil Parks, 13. If the island was so protected, how come Steve and all the Germans stumbled across it so easily? I think it's just law of averages, and the world has changed, and there are planes, and people fly planes more easily, and there he goes.
It may also be related to Diana's first use of her power, which happened just before that. So, which would make Hippolyta right about worrying that Diana's power would bring Ares quicker.
So what, he was flying in a completely different
No, he was
direction.
Like flying in the area, but he would have been fine. He would have gone around it. But because of her power, that weakened the barrier.
Uh-huh.
And then that's when he crashed through.
Interesting. Also interesting that we meet him flying a plane and he ends the film flying a plane.
Oh, yeah.
Both, I guess, with altruistic purposes, but clearly one is a suicide mission and one isn't. At least he's trying not to kill himself at the beginning. Shows a growth of character, I would say. Giuseppe Deluxe, do you think all the other gods are really dead?
Possibly not. They could be like just away somewhere.
Okay.
I think it's just a case of muddying the mythology, isn't it? I mean, the DCEU is problematic enough as it is with all these intertwining backstories. I think if you introduce the entire Grecian pantheon, you've kind of got a problem.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
I think Zeus is dead, Ares is in, and now Ares is gone. Right, God's reset.
I'm just saying they're in like the sin bin, and you could pull one out if you need to, but you probably won't.
No.
Yeah.
And then the very last question comes from Chiffon_AM and asks, on the subject of Wonder Woman, could you and Helen explain with small words what you liked about this movie? Because I didn't get it. I was so ready to like it. And essentially, Diana is a... I'll read out the excerpts. Diana is a superpowered toddler.
No.
Everything went sharply downhill after they left Themyscira.
No.
Everyone she met was a stereotype.
No.
Or
one-dimensional.
No.
It might even be worse than Thor. Come on, Chiffon.
Hey.
Come on. Come on.
First of all, Thor is excellent.
Yes.
small words. I mean, I just thought it was fantastic and staring and heroic and romantic and I and funny as well and moving, unexpectedly moving for me. I thought they were great together, Gadot and Pine. I thought the other characters around them were not the stereotypes that I thought that we would see in a movie like this, and it really surprised the hell out of me.
It was super charming, I thought. Basically, all that you said, and then just that.
Terry, James, final words on this movie?
Warm and funny and authentic, and we haven't really got into this, but I think you can't understate the importance and significance of this for young female cinema goers to see Wonder Woman, a amazing female protagonist, and also the creation of a female filmmaker on screen.
Amen.
Joyous and charming, I would say, which for a DC film is actually saying a lot. No, I thought it was great. And also, I think it is only right on this particular podcast and in general that we have talked about the film on its merits as a film and not got hung up on the gendered side of this. And I think one of the biggest problems with the fact this film's been received by a lot of critics is everyone's gone so hung up on the gendered issues here, when actually it's just a good superhero film, irrespective of gender. And I think it's just loads of fun. I think you just need to accept it for that. It is a great superhero film. It joins a lot of other great superhero films. You know, it is flawed, primarily at the end, but it's great. Like it.
I will end with asking Terry very, very quickly your theory that you shared with us briefly in the cab on the way here, that Wonder Woman is frozen.
Please explain this.
Wonder Woman is totally frozen. Uh-huh. Right. So,
yeah.
Well, Steve Rogers is frozen.
So,
we're getting them wrong.
Obviously, everything she touches turns to ice. She's given the gloves by her parents, locked in the room because she's going
to... She's told to control her powers.
Power, not use her powers, yeah. Because it will draw attention, it will put her at risk.
Yeah.
Okay, and Frozen is essentially a journey of a young woman learning to not just harness, but love and appreciate the power within her. And only when she does that can she save the world.
And she does it for love at the end, you're right.
Yes.
She saves her sister through love.
Just to play devil's advocate, save the world that she doomed. Let's not miss that point.
James Splaining. We came up with this today. James Splaining. James Splaining everywhere.
She brought on an eternal winter. It's entirely her own doing.
Yes, well, but then she saved the world. And actually, that wasn't her fault, because if she hadn't been told that her power wasn't safe and that it wasn't something she could explore...
She would have been able to control it years ago.
Yes.
James, you've been Wonder Woman explained.
Yeah, fair enough.
Learn to let it go. Let it go, mate.
Yeah.
Don't hold it back.
Don't hold it back anymore.
Do you want to build a snowman?
Yeah.
Let's do it. All right, that is it for our Wonder Woman spoiler special. Hope you guys enjoyed it. If you've any more questions, do send them in via Twitter. Our next spoiler special will be for The Mummy with director Alex Kurtzman talking to Helen in that one. That'll be out on Monday, June 12th. In the meantime, the regular podcast is up every Friday as well. If you don't already listen to that, then please do listen to it and subscribe via iTunes as well. Right, that is it from James.
Bye.
From Terry.
Goodbye.
It is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to try and find Themyscira. Can't even spell the bloody thing, but I will find it. 4 stars on TripAdvisor. Thanks for listening. Bye.